Going to begin. Leave the people in the back in freedom to take as long as they want to get their snacks. All right, so freedom and rationality is the overall topic of the camp, and I want to talk about freedom of speech and expression. So these will be the categories under which we look. Freedom of speech in the USA and Canada. Yes, we are part of North America. Do we have it right? And I'll tip my hand, I think maybe not. What does the Lord think about freedom? Does the Lord recommend limiting freedom? Who gets to set the limits on freedom? What happens when civil laws conflict with spiritual laws? How does discriminate charity interact with individual freedoms? What would solve most of these problems besides me getting to be in charge? First slide. Freedom of speech in the USA and Canada. Now, this is a summary, and for all you lawyers, just buy what I'm selling here. Summary of First Amendment to the United States Constitution, it says, prohibits the making of any law respecting an establishment of religion, impeding the free exercise of religion, abridging the freedom of speech, infringing on the freedom of the press, interfering with the right to peaceably assemble, or prohibiting the petitioning for a governmental redress of grievances. And then it says, in the last half century, many freedom of speech cases have centered on whether or not people have the right to publish or say or do something that some find objectionable, such as possess child pornography, disagree that homosexuals are born that way, burn the flag in protest of the American government. This can loosely be called the freedom of expression. So there was the freedom of speech protected, and then that was expanded out to freedom of expression. And a couple cases you're probably aware of, and I don't want it to get into a debate of specific cases, but for instance, I know in Canada, pornography has been defended as freedom of expression. Is that what we want when we talk about freedom in society? Your freedom to be able to do those things. Should that be protected, that kind of freedom? Another one I remember, I think this was in Washington, D.C. years ago, some artist thought it was a great idea to put a crucifix with Jesus on it in a bottle of urine to protest what he thought Christianity was all about. Is that allowable freedoms of expression that are healthy in the long run for society to be able to maintain that kind of freedom? It says here, the Supreme Court generally, though, has considered freedom of expression to be included in the freedom of speech clause, so it has ruled that flag burning is protected in spite of the protests of most Americans. So that's a bubble statement about that. Lawyers can debate later if it was fair. Canada has an interesting difference. Freedom of speech in Canada is protected as a fundamental freedom by Section 2 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Unlike many democracies, freedom of speech in Canada is not absolute. Section 1 of the Charter allows the government, to pass laws that limit free expression. But notice this, so long as the limits are reasonable and can be justified. So, who gets to decide what is reasonable and justified when it comes to limiting speech and expression? I do. I'm Canadian. Well, this is the thing that we're going to get into. Now, it says this can often be the subject of controversy, as some feel the conditions for reasonable justification are vague, granting the government an unreasonable amount of control over freedom of speech. And so there's this wonderful interplay that happens between we generally laud freedom of speech and expression when it's stuff that we like, and then when it's stuff that impinges on what we like or think is healthy, we begin to wonder how much freedom is a good thing. And I remember specifically a dear old lady in one of my morning doctrinal classes. She hated this freedom thing a lot. She's like, I really think it would be better if the Lord did come down and stop certain things. So, you know, she said, I would be willing to give up some of my freedom if the Lord would come in and stop certain things. And I have to say, sometimes I feel like, yeah, that would be really neat if he would just come down and say, okay, that's over the line. We're not doing that. So these are the things we debate. And I remember one case in Canada, again in Montreal. Think about this one, because another facet of this in your discussions is going to be individual freedoms versus public freedoms. Like, where's that intersection where the rights of the whole have greater weight than your individual freedoms? And in this case, it was a community. Think of some of the church communities we have: Bernathan, Glenview, Carindale, all those types of things, where we specifically got a group of people together and said, this is sort of what we want this group to stand for. There's a group like this in Montreal, and a couple moved into a house there, and they were swingers, and they had a network, and they got quite a gathering of people swapping spouses, coming in and out of the house, and the community got together and said, we don't think that should be allowed in our community. We don't like it. And it went right up through the courts, and ultimately the Canadian Supreme Court said they're consenting adults, they are allowed to do what they want. If you don't like it, move. So is that a right protection of freedom? Because their sense of what freedom was and what they should be able to do was impacting people living in the neighborhood who felt, we don't really want our children exposed to that kind of behavior. But the government said, consenting adults, free to do whatever they want. Is that a good thing? Any thoughts? Okay, so he raises something we're going to get back to, is the laws we're living by, who gets to determine what those laws are? And he mentioned law of the Lord.
I think one of your key things is, on a secular level, what do you mean by exposure? Because what goes on in the house is different from what goes on outside of the house in terms of providing instruction, as it were, not necessarily good instruction, for the neighbors or the kids. And there might have been a key there that you can deal with.
Yeah. So the reason I bring those ones up, because I think a lot of these cases you can debate one side or another what specific things were, but I think what we butt up against all the time is freedom, land of the free, home of the brave, in the U.S., in Canada, true north, strong and free, we have this idea that freedom is a good thing. And yet, so often, issues that we have are when we are butting up against freedom.
When you asked, should this be allowable, were you asking from doctrine?
Well, see, that yes.
Then no, because adultery should be illegal by civil law, according to doctrine.
Aha. And so, law of the Lord, we might all be in agreement on what that is, but we live in these mishmash communities of multiple religions, and I know you already know the answer to this, but I'm going to evoke Matthew's not letting ministers talk law unless I want. Tanny. Okay, see, we're getting into specifics, and now we can go right off the rails. I'll go 1, 2, 3.
So what about smoking then? Because you can smoke a cigarette by yourself, but the secondhand smoke affects everyone around you. So is that illegal now?
Depends which way the breeze is blowing. Nice and loud. We will be getting into some of the difference between those two, freedom and license.
I'm just wondering who the sinners were that Jesus was accused of mingling with. And what's the whole doctrine on that?
Yeah. Okay, so hold all those questions. Let's turn our attention. Because it really is an important thing to think about what the Lord really does say about freedom. So, does the Lord like freedom? Okay, so Matthew was very heavy on the importance of freedom, and I'm here to take some of that freedom away. But there is a good basis for freedom being really important from the Lord's point of view. This TCR passage... Oh no, I'm jumping ahead. Okay, first law of divine providence. So we know that in series the first thing weighs very heavily. Law of divine providence that man should act from freedom in accordance with reason. Everyone knows that man has the freedom to think and will just as he pleases. And I should have gone with like a bigger font size and maybe colored these letters, but not the freedom to say whatever he thinks or to do whatever he wills. So freedom to think and will as he pleases, but not necessarily to say and do. Critical in raising children. Think and will whatever you please, but there is a line. Okay, so we'll leave that one. This is that well-known one that the Lord guards freedom in a person as a person guards the pupil of his own eye. So here, TCR 807, the English nation, remember, Swedenborg had to go and publish in England. Why? Because they had freedom. Freedom of the press. Freedom to publish new ideas. That was critical for the second coming, that there was a place in the world that would allow these new ideas to come forward. So freedom is really important. And it says that the English, now we can debate whether that's true today still, have an interior intellectual light. a light that is not manifest to anyone in the natural world, but it is clearly manifest in the spiritual world. This light they acquire from their freedom of speech and of the press, and consequent freedom of thought. With others who have not such freedom, that light is suppressed because it has no outlet. So there is this value in being able to banty these new ideas around. The back and forth, the interplay encourages a freedom of thought. So that seems like freedom's a pretty good thing. As does this one. When the freedom to speak and write is restricted, so is freedom of thought. That is to say, freedom to take the widest view of things is kept under restriction. Notice the bottom bolded part. Likewise, understanding from a higher level is proportional to the freedom to speak and to express one's thoughts. So there is this value of people being able to have this interchange of ideas where freedom of speech, not restricted, allows for developing this higher thought. And I have a little story about, I visit Cuba 3 or 4 times a year, church group down there. Do they have freedom of speech and expression? And one of our translators down there has a young man, 16 years old, wants to become a journalist. And his father, who has been in that system down there, is saying, dumb idea to be a journalist in Cuba, because you write your script, then you give it to the government, they change it and print it. It never comes back to you. So the final edit of what you write is exactly what the government wants it to say. And so, you know, this young man who has all these ideas that he wants to share with the Cuban people, his father's like, you're wasting your time because you can write whatever you want, but that's not what people are going to get to read. So, you know, they're living in a country where, yeah, they would kill to have the freedom of speech and expression that we have. And yet we living in it sometimes are thinking, maybe we step over that line too much and wouldn't mind a little limiting. Okay, DP 23. The Lord provides for the union of goodness and truth in others through the equilibrium between heaven and hell. Every person is held in this equilibrium as long as he lives in the world and kept thereby in the freedom of thinking, willing, speaking, and acting in which he can be reformed. So nobody, it's a principle, nobody can be reformed under compulsion. So freedom is important that people can explore these ideas, make free choices, and thereby the Lord can work with them and reform them. So, are we in agreement the Lord holds freedom as pretty important? I think so. Here's where we get to take it away. All right. Heaven and Hell 597. Talking about the spiritual equilibrium. This freedom is given to every man by the Lord and is never taken away. In fact, by virtue of its origin, it is not man's but the Lord's, since it is from the Lord. Nevertheless, it is given to man with his life as it were his, and this is done that man may have the ability to be reformed and saved, for without freedom there can be no reformation or salvation. Without any rational intuition, anyone can see that it is part of man's freedom to be able to think wrongly or rightly, sincerely or insincerely, justly or unjustly, also that he is free to speak and act rightly, honestly, and justly, but not to speak and act wrongly, insincerely, and unjustly, because of the spiritual, moral, and civil laws whereby his external is held in restraint. Evidently, then, it is man's spirit which thinks and wills that is in freedom, and not his external which speaks and acts, except in agreement with the above-mentioned laws. I think that is maybe one of the hinges where I think we're a little off track in our nations, where we assume that the freedom to speak and do is also not to be restricted in any way. And I think what the Lord is talking about that is essential is the spiritual freedom to will and think whatever you please. But yes, the external, when it comes to taking those ideas and speaking them or acting upon them, then yes, society necessarily will have to have some restraints and restrictions, because Stanley said, sometimes one person's freedom is going to infringe upon another person's freedom, and somehow there has to be a set of laws which says, well, in act and in speech, these are the limitations we're setting up. You can still will and think whatever you want, but here we're going to draw the line in external. Okay, hold that thought. We might change your mind. Okay. DP 283, it is admitted that man has full liberty to think and will, but not full liberty to say and to do whatever he thinks and wills. So it's assuming that we know this. It's admitted in society that, yes, we have the liberty to think and will whatever we want, but not necessarily to say and do. And this is where the point of debate, whenever you talk about founding fathers, I think they probably would have agreed with that. I think many people today have taken the liberty to think and will and think that necessarily translates into the ability to say and do whatever you want. And I'm not sure that's a healthy place to be. Notice this, for he can think like an atheist, can deny God, can blaspheme the holy things of the Word and the Church, and can even desire to destroy them by word and deed to their utter extermination, but this is prevented by civil, moral, and ecclesiastical laws. So, it appears to me the Lord is assuming that society will be smart enough to draw certain lines in the external. Yes, we're getting to that, and we'll probably steamroll over that, because I've had some fascinating conversations. To me, it is clear as a bell in the writings, and I don't have that whole class with me for the PowerPoint, but I think the writings are very clear that the idea is spiritual law flows into rational law and into moral law and into civil law, is how it's supposed to go. But I have met many sincere new church people who have said, well, no, civil law is in this box over here, and what I believe is over here, and ne'er the twain shall meet, as though there's not supposed to be any connection. And I think some of the confusion we have over that is under the separation of church and state. And what I think has happened is that as we can't agree on what religious principles should be operating in our society, we've decided it's easier to throw out religion altogether and just let human intelligence decide what the rules of the day are going to be. And I think that the Lord says anything that truly can be called a religion has at least the Ten Commandments as a basis, and that should be founded and supported in civil law. All right. Looking at my watch. As usual, we're behind. So it is the law of divine providence that man's understanding and will should not be compelled in the least by another. So we should not be trying to get in somebody's head and compel what they will and think. For who is not able to think and will evil or good against the laws or with the laws, against the king or with the king, against God or with God? Yet man is not allowed to speak and do everything he thinks and wills. By the way, this was something that made total sense to me as a teen. I can remember my father when I, you know, tried to do the challenge thing of the church every Sunday. But worship, Dad, cannot be compelled. I cannot be reformed except in a state of freedom. And playing that whole game, to which he said, you are free to will and think whatever you want while you are there, but God has put you under my roof, and in the external, we are going to have you go to church. While you're there, will and think whatever you want, but as long as you are under our house and you're not master of your own domain, you will comply to this external. And that actually made a lot of sense to me. He never tried to force me to be new church. He never tried to force me to believe the things that he cherished and believed. But in the external, in the act, he said, this is our house, this is what we stand for, this is what we do. And just that little bit of knowing that he was not trying to force my internal made me feel free to eventually choose those things. Yeah.
So when the Supreme Court of the United States linked speech and action together by calling the action and expression the same as speech, they are contradicting what we see as...
I think so. Okay. So we're going to have to save time to try and solve these problems. Here, I think, really gets to the crux. I think what the Lord holds precious and dear particularly is that spiritual freedom, that heavenly freedom. Hellish freedom is one thing, heavenly freedom another. It is an exercise of hellish freedom to think and will evil, and so far as civil and moral laws do not hinder, to speak and do it. It is an exercise of heavenly freedom, on the other hand, to think and will good, and so far as opportunity is given, to speak and do it. That's the wonderful thing about heavenly freedom, is you get to think and will it, and any time opportunity presents itself, you get to do it. That's what I think the Lord really is wanting for society. Hellish freedom is... yes, I get to think and will it, but I only get to speak and do it if it's not against the laws or I don't get caught kind of thing. And so I think the Lord is telling us that society needs certain laws on the external plane that are spiritual, rational, moral, and civil, saying these things, as a society, we say, don't go. And we do that for certain things. Murder, we're still holding that as a pretty good tenet of don't do that. Adultery, we're pretty pro that anymore. There's no real protection on the civil plane there. Perjury, still take that pretty seriously, but not overly. So you can see there that civil law is not necessarily following spiritual law anymore. So if we agree that there is a use to limiting certain freedoms in act and in speech, who gets to decide? Because that's really important. NJHD 312, order cannot be maintained in the world without persons in authority, like Fidel Castro, who ought to take notice of all things which happen according to order and of all things which take place in opposition to order. And who ought to reward those who live according to order and punish those who live in opposition to order? Unless, therefore, men are kept in bonds by the laws and by rewards suitable to their loves, which are honors and gains for those who do good, and by punishments in opposition to those loves for those who do evil, and which consist in loss of honor, of possessions, and of life, the human race would perish. So I think the Lord assumes that society will see the necessity for putting certain limits on external freedoms that are of danger to society. All right. Persons in authority, therefore, are necessary for keeping the assemblages of men in order. Which persons ought to be skilled in the laws, wise, and God-fearing? Wouldn't that be amazing? Order also should be among those in authority, lest anyone from favor of ignorance should permit evils which are in opposition to order and should thereby destroy order. And I just want to mention somebody, and again, I don't want to get political because I'm not a political being, but there is, who knows Marco Rubio in Florida? I don't know that much about him. I still follow Florida things because I love Florida, but I was so impressed where, you know, he's now a presidential candidate and he was in some news conference and somebody knew that he was pro-life. And, you know, that's not a good ticket to run on these days. So, you know, they zeroed in on him to, you know, bring him out for this hidden thing that he had. And he simply said, look, I'm a Catholic. And, you know, my religion teaches this and that. And, you know, my first duty is to God and to do those things that I believe he teaches. So I have no other choice but to act upon that conscience. And I was just like, when is the last time I heard a politician just acknowledge that he's trying to do God's will, that, you know, he's part of this religion and, you know, that's it. And so he's got to do that. And I just thought, wow, I had not heard words like that come out of a politician's mouth in a long time. And it was just refreshing to at least have that idea of God enter the conversation. Okay. There ought to be obedience to the king according to the laws of the realm, nor should he be injured by any means, either by deeds or words. for on this public security depends. So there is some injunction not to beat up on your leaders unnecessarily, which impacts their ability to lead. Now, I would say that's assuming they're God-fearing. Moreover, in kingdoms where justice and judgment are guarded, men are compelled not to speak against religion. I think we're pretty free in these nations to speak against religion all we want. TCR 55, just giving the ordering, in empires, kingdoms, etc., in each one of them, the laws of justice are in the highest place, political laws in the second, economic laws in the third. And I'm just going to skip over that one because that's a whole different class. Okay, so I'm also going to skip through this section because I want to get some discussion in. What happens when civil laws conflict with spiritual laws? We certainly know our churches are going to be running into this. Canada, depending which way you look at it, is about 20 years ahead or behind the USA in court decisions regarding gay marriage. So in Canada, we've had this federal mandate for a while, and so it's nothing new to us up there. It's new to you here, and so people are trying to figure out what does this mean now for churches where their church might teach one thing, and civil law is saying another. And long and short of it, I do believe the outline the writings give is your highest allegiance needs to be to spiritual law. If you're forced into a decision and a choice has to be made, I think you got to stick with spiritual law. But I would also argue that the Lord cannot operate except through the agency of human beings. So if we are not happy with civil laws because they're not in accord with divine laws, then how is the Lord going to bring those things into alignment? He can't do it except through people saying for their society they wish society would act this way or that way. Okay, so I'm skipping through these Doctrine of Charity ones. Now, what happens in the realm of spiritual law? So if we assume spiritual law gets to rule, what happens if in your church their take on spiritual law does not accord with yours? Here's this wonderful passage in two sections. Priests ought to teach the people and through truths ought to lead them to the good of life, but still they ought not to compel anyone. It'd be a lot simpler as a priest if the period had gone at the end of that sentence. Since no one can be compelled to believe what is opposed to that which in his heart he has thought to be true. Actually, period could go at the end of that. It'd still be easy. He who believes differently from the priest and does not make any disturbances ought to be left in peace. Period probably could have gone at the end there and it still would have been easy, but this is the one that causes all the turmoil. But he who makes disturbances ought to be separated, for this also belongs to the order for the sake of which the priesthood is. Who gets to decide what constitutes disturbance? By the way, this is why I became a priest. No. It's one of those things where we can have these arguments in the civil realm as well. Who gets to decide where the limits on freedom to speak and act are in the civil realm? Same things in the spiritual realm. One of the beauties of the new church is we can enter with understanding into mysteries of faith. It's one of our hallmarks. And that gift also leads to lots of debate, contention, so on and so forth. And at times in our history, things have reached boiling points where, things happen. And no longer is that healthy tension between debate of ideas healthy, begins to become self-destructive, and then, changes happen. But this is that constant edge that I think the Lord is, we need to have freedom. That's what is going to open the interiors of our mind to explore, to make the Lord's good and truth our own, and thereby allow us to be saved. So that freedom is sacrosanct, and yet, in speech and in act, there comes times where to say and do whatever we please is not healthy, either for ourselves or for the people around us. And then it comes to, well, okay, if we think there has to be limits, who gets to set those limits? How? And it's a tricky thing to navigate freedom. Okay. We're going to skip right over these. You can read them in the packet. I think this also gets into discriminate charity. All those wonderful teachings we have where the Lord tells us that the simple cannot act with discrimination. You know, their idea of what is good and charitable is simply to do good deeds for whoever wants them. But it says, unless it is known what is meant by a neighbor, charity may be practiced indiscriminately and in like manner towards the evil and good, whereby charity becomes no charity. The next number, it is in the interest of Christian prudence to examine well the quality of a man's life and to exercise charity to him accordingly. The man of the internal church exercises his charity with discrimination, consequently with intelligence. But the man of the external church, because he is not able to thus discern things, does it indiscriminately. And the last one, a devil man may explain, I am your neighbor, do good to me, and if you do good to him, he may kill you or others. You are placing a knife or a sword in his hand. So one of the things that was interesting, we've been studying the Arcana and the Exodus recently, and it makes a big point how in the other world, the evil spirits use the simple good as their minions. They know that some people might twig on if an evil spirit was trying to get them to embrace something or do something, but the simple good folks, the evil spirits realize they're easy to dupe. And so if you can get the simple good carrying on the agenda of the hells, who wants to, go to war with a simple, good-meaning person? And it's a great strategy the hells use to get the simple good to carry out what they want to have done. And so there's a necessity, I believe, in the new church where we should know better to be able to act with some discrimination and in the external realm at times say, no, you can't say that, you can't do that. You can think and will it all you want, but It's not good for you. It's not good for society for you to promote that kind of thing. Okay. And lots more about discriminate charity and individual freedoms. AC 629:14. To love the neighbor is to love what is true and good, likewise what is sincere and just. But no other thought or judgment here is meant than concerning the spiritual life of another. Spiritual life, you can't do that, can be seen from this, that it is permissible to everyone to think about the moral and civil life of another and to judge of it. Without such thought and judgment concerning others, no civil society could subsist. All right, more on these. Again, this is a whole separate class, but we know the conjugal love 523 one, saying that if we don't make judgments on moral and civil in society, it's going to collapse. And so I think that gets into the realm of limiting external speech and act. And if we don't do any of that, society is going to quickly look like hell on earth. Okay, skipping on. What would solve most of these problems? Yes. Yeah. No, trust me, that is not what the Lord had in mind.
I can vouch for that.
Yeah. But it is known that internal men, that is those who have conscience, have an internal bond by which they are bound, namely that of conscience. This is really what the Lord wants, is people to be bound by conscience, not by external laws. The internal man is also of such a character that he loves to speak and act from freedom, but not from compulsion. For with them the internal compels the external and not the reverse. This is what the Lord really wants, is people to know his truth, understand his truth, and freely choose to compel themselves to live according to that truth. And if people were doing that, civil law wouldn't even be an issue. We wouldn't have to have that round and around discussion of what's fair. People would be learning what the Lord wants and doing it. This is what I really think is the key, probably made the biggest difference in my life. We need, I believe, in the new church to teach people that they need to compel themselves. If you learn to do this, external people don't have to compel you. And a story that really made an impact on me, a dishwashing story, hopefully you haven't heard it, but I was being compelled to do the dishes, which I still hate doing to this day. That really hasn't changed, but I was fuming, like black cloud, just welcoming the hells in, just come on in. And my father, I think, at some point had had enough. He stood up, he came into the kitchen, and he said, look, you are a part of this family, and we all have to contribute, and yes, I am making you do the dishes, and you're furious about it. He's like, if you don't want to be furious about it, you know it's the right thing to do. Make yourself do it, and I won't have to make you do the dishes. And he walked out, and I was still fuming. But those words were just marinating, that if I don't want him all up in my grill messing with me, if I do the right thing, choose to do it, he's out of the picture. I'm doing my own thing. And I really think it's an important thing. We need to teach people that if you don't want your respected elders, your parents, your teachers, your boss, you know, if you don't want people always telling you what you have to do, learn what the right thing is, and I would say 99% of the time, people are going to be quite happy with that, and they're not going to be telling you what you should do. And the other thing is, there is the beautiful thing about these passages on self-compulsion is that there is freedom in that. We are the only creatures that can freely choose to go against what we might want, what we might naturally desire. And the writings say that is an internal freedom that is actually the source of true happiness. And think about that thing where Matthew is saying, you know, the Lord's got a tricky job because, you know, it says we all incline to hell and the Lord is trying to get us to go 180 degrees opposite of where we naturally are inclined to go. And he knows we cannot be compelled internally, and so he has to leave us in freedom to go completely opposite of where we want to go. And self-compulsion, I think, is that mechanism the Lord gives us to say, yes, you can actually learn what I have to say is the right thing to do, and then you can even make yourself do that even though you don't feel like you want to. And if you use that mechanism to compel yourself, eventually you're going to find that you love doing it. And you're going to embrace doing it, and that's where the joy is going to come from. So I really think, and I said something yesterday in one of the afternoon sessions, I am not a proponent of catering to wants of people. I wanted a lot of things when I was young that were not healthy, were not beneficial. And I don't want people just trying to say, hey, Brad, what do you want? Let's give you what you want that will make you happy. No, what we should be giving people is what the Lord gives them. And those are the truths of his word, because those are the things that ultimately are going to make them happy. And so I think what we need to teach them is you can make yourself want the things that the Lord teaches you. At first, you're going to have to compel yourself to go to his word, learn those things, understand them, and then you're going to have to make yourself do them, and eventually you will find that you love those things and they do bring you happiness. So I would encourage you all to do more with promoting this wonderful doctrine of self-compulsion, because it really, in the long run, will get rid of this whole debate about having to compel externals, speech and act, and having that whole line of, you know, when do we limit this, when don't we? It'll be, no, people are turning to the Lord and his word. They're going to do what he says, even if they don't like it. And society becomes a much better and happier place. Okay, so I have all these passages in packets I'm going to hand out to you. Some questions I think you might want to talk about, but of course you are in freedom once you leave this room. Do you think the U.S. and Canada have the freedom of speech right? How can we survive in a world where freedom of speech is often diametrically opposed to the spiritual things of the church? Is there a difference, Joe alluded to this, between freedom of speech and freedom of expression? Is freedom of speech and expression demonstrably different than advocacy? In the church, where is the line where the freedom to speak and do as one pleases, where does that get crossed? So good questions. Another one I think could be individual freedoms versus public freedoms. Take it where you want, but that's all I have.